Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
True West Magazine, May-June 2024 edition. The Last Hurrah by Linda A. Sanchez. General John Blackjack Pershing assigned the Apache scouts from the 10th and 11th Cavalry the task of tracking Pancho Villa. Enough is good, they acknowledge. The taste of new adventure and the hunt for the elusive bandit and his soldiers stirred in their warrior hearts. The violence and upheaval of the Apache campaigns of the 1880s were long past, compared to the dozens of scouts and troops who combed the Southwest and Mexico for renegade Apaches, refusing to be confined on reservations. 1916 was pretty quiet. These particular Apache scouts were a band of brothers. They were tough and could track, fight, and ride as their predecessors once did. But they were also immobilized in a time warp with tedious, uninspiring duty. That changed dramatically on March 9, 1916, when Pancho Villa and his angry revolucionarios had the audacity to wreak havoc on the border community of Columbus, New Mexico. Sprawled along the border, the small town was a blur of dust devils and no rain. The Mexican Revolution had brought betrayal and bloodshed for 6 long years to many citizens of both nations. The shock of that brutal assault on U.S. soil would not be tolerated. Villa had badly misjudged the leadership in Washington, and while hoping to jumpstart the purpose of the revolution, which was Tierra y Libertad, land and freedom, this unfortunately backfired. The angry bandit general finally cut ties with President Woodrow Wilson and all the political chicanery of that administration's lackadaisical attitude toward Mexico. Fury had overwhelmed Villa when he learned that the U.S. was supplying arms to his bitter rival, Venustiano Carranza. Villa despised Carranza because, by Villa's rough standards, the man was a coward and a pompous rico who had achieved power without fighting the evil of General Huerta. Thus, the treachery of the United States stung, and Villa did what he knew best. He rode out of nowhere and attacked, killing and maiming citizens of the U.S. and leaving his own war dead strewn across the landscape. The United States government, usually slow in its reactions, seemed to move like the wind. Within a short time, thousands of men were called to duties to capture and punish Villa and his Dorados. Selected to lead this punitive expedition, also known as the Mexican Expedition, was Brigadier General Blackjack Pershing. Pershing well remembered his frontier experience and service in New Mexico during the Indian Wars. He was a strong disciplinarian and had a gift for organization. Wanting to complete the assignment quickly and efficiently, Pershing submitted a special request for Apache scouts because he was familiar with their ability and expertise in tracking techniques. Now, if Pershing could just get Washington off his back. Unfortunately, President Woodrow Wilson was always trying to second-guess his military commanders. Little did the scouts realize that the few years they had remaining would pale in comparison to the exciting months chasing Villa, scouting for General Blackjack Pershing, and serving their nation. Old traditions die hard. Several of the older scouts had served or had relatives who served during the Geronimo campaigns. Only 24 remained in 1916. However, Pershing increased their ranks to 35 during the punitive expedition. They would serve their last major assignment yet again in Mexico. Despite 30 years of relative peace along the border, Apache scouts were a little nervous about riding into the land of their traditional enemy, the Mexicans. Their view of the world did not distinguish between friendly Mexicans and the Carrantistas or Villistas. To their minds, shoot 'em all seemed to be the order of the day. Caution was much more a part of the march forward than they expected. Ace Duke Lugie, nephew of Geronimo, told historian Eve Ball, when describing scout activity, that an Apache never wanted to be surprised. No surprise equals survival. Successful commanders, including Captains John G. Bourke, Emmett Crawford, and Lieutenants Britton Davis, Charles B. Gatewood, James Shannon, and H.B. Warfield, realized the greater leeway they allowed the Apache scouts with regard to their culture and beliefs, the more responsive the attitudes would be toward military life. U.S. Army Captain John G. Bourke described the Apache scouts on the campaign in pursuit of the Chiricahua Apaches in 1883 as following the ways of the natural environment. The scout knew every nook and cranny, every trail or mark along the way that told a story of people or animals passing by. A scout's value was in their natural skills they were taught from childhood. More than 30 years later, Captain James Shannon, commanding officer of scouts, wrote, "In order to get results, he must be allowed to play that game in his own way. This extreme caution is one of the qualities that makes him a perfect scout. It would almost be impossible to surprise an outfit that had a detachment of Apache scouts in its front." Although raised in the East, Lieutenant Shannon had developed a true appreciation for his Apache scouts. He praised them for keeping an orderly camp, care of their horses, and especially their traditional Apache religious rites. He found that they used the sweat lodge almost daily, and each man carried several sacred objects of power in their pockets of their uniforms, such as hodaten, the sacred pollen they all valued and used for daily prayers. These were the men following the trail of Villa and his gang of cutthroats, as the American press now described them. Battles at Rancho Ojos Azules and Las Varas Pass. Though there were many skirmishes and incidents, two major encounters during which the Apache scouts rode point and relished the battle experience as well as the scouting phase of their duties occurred in May and June of 1916. Rancho Ojos Azules. Historian Frederick Katz called the action at Rancho Ojos Azules the greatest victory that the punitive expedition would achieve. It also improved morale among the troops. The Apache scouts enjoyed every minute of this encounter. It allowed them to prove they could fight as well as track. On May 5th, after a forced march of 35 miles, a group of scouts and members of the 11th Cavalry came to El Rancho Ojos Azules, Blue Springs. Many Villistas were known to be in the area. It could be a great opportunity to actually engage the enemy that had attacked the United States and possibly corner Villa himself. Julio Acosta led some 150 or more seasoned soldiers loyal to Villa. Major Robert L. Howes hastily assembled six troops of the 11th Cavalry, a machine gun troop, a pack train loaded with 4 days' rations, and the Apache scouts who fanned out as an advance guard for the main column. A handful of American officers and about 140 enlisted men fought against the Villistas. Incredibly, not one American was wounded in battle, but over 50 of the Villistas were reported killed in action, with at least that many captured. Major Howes, eager to field a victory, had continued his forced night march in an effort to achieve total surprise the next morning. Exactly a month earlier, he had been forced to give up a pursuit of Villa himself due to a lack of Apache scouts to follow the trail. His Apache scouts had been accused of committing atrocities. Thus, he had to temporarily suspend their operations. This put the men at a distinct disadvantage without scouts to follow the clever and evasive Dorados. It was very frustrating for all involved. This time, Howes sensed that the trap was closing with the aid of his Apaches and the two civilian guides. At sunrise, the combined forces deployed and the Ojos Azules charge began. According to some reports, Ojos Azules is remembered as the last American cavalry campaign fought in the frontier way. It was clean and near perfect as dozens of Villistas were caught in the crossfire, and this cavalry charge was typical of the Americanos' classic fighting style. Major Howes, with Troop A, was to act as a mounted advance guard for the 11th Cavalry Troops. The original plan for the scouts was to find the Villistas and prevent them from escaping. However, the Apaches, unable to resist once they located the enemy, dismounted in their traditional style and fought until the remainder of Howes's troops arrived. It was reported that they fought well side by side with regular cavalry troops. A charge with pistols through the ranch, made in columns of four, ended with the enemies fleeing for their lives. Other troops deployed to either side of the ranch house blocked escape by use of the machine gun brigade. Apache scouts eagerly led the way against their traditional Mexican enemies. This was an unusual move in that the scouts were supposed to locate the enemy and then get the hell out of the way. First Lieutenant S.M. Williams, adjutant and quartermaster for the expedition, later wrote in an article for the U.S. Cavalry Journal about his experiences at the Ojos Azules fight, describing that this battle lasted for at least 20 to 25 minutes of furious fighting, accompanied by Apache scouts shrieking shrill war whoops. Additionally, they also returned to camp with their booty, saddles, bridles, captured horses and mules, ammo, blankets, rifles, and pistols. Afterwards, First Sergeant Chicken Esquihandista is recorded as saying, "Huli, damn fine fight." His men agreed. It was a stunning feat for scouts and troopers because the forced all-night march with horses and mules carrying extra loads was difficult for man and beast, and they were war-weary upon arrival at Ojos Azules. Courage and spontaneity carried the day as scouts and soldiers fought together well, carefully, and with lightning speed when necessary. Las Varas Pass. About a month later, on June 2nd, Lieutenant Shannon and his 20 Apache scouts fought with some of the Candelario Cervantes's men. They had stolen horses from the 5th Cavalry. Stealing horses and mules became a game and a hard-fought one in some cases. Though the Villistas' trail was over a week old, the scouts tracked the men to Las Varas Pass. Captain Shannon noted that his scouts took a short time to relocate the trail after a rocky stretch caused them to slow. The Apaches circled out, and soon one motioned for the others, and then the rest started off again, using the same technique. Within the hour, they quickly dispersed the ladrones, thieves, as they scattered into the mountains. There were no losses of men, but once again, no via. The Ojos Azules and Las Varas Pass battles did not go unnoticed in Carranza's Mexico City, even though the casualties had been entirely Villistas. Villistas at Ojos Azules later admitted that fighting against the feared Apaches was an unnerving experience. On June 28, 1916, Mexico's representative to the United States, Eliseo Arredondo, sent a harsh note to Secretary of State Lansing, contending again that Pershing's officers and Apaches had committed atrocities that would not be forgiven. Pershing responded that these rumors had persisted for some time, but that investigations showed the charges to be unjustified. General Pershing's findings have satisfied historians ever since then. Unfortunately, it slowed down the progress in finding Villa for several months. Remarkably, the military reports of their commanders indicate the officers all believed that with better usage of the scouts, Villa himself would have been apprehended. That was the purpose, after all, of the punitive expedition. Mexico City was as inept as Washington when it came to understanding field conditions. Lucky for Villa, but not for Carranza, as his autocrats in the capital. During the 7 months waiting to placate Carranza, the Apaches spent a significant amount of their Mexican service tracking down American deserters and general scouting or hunting forays and repairing telegraph wires cut by the enemy. Shannon took his scouts out for hunts just to prevent boredom and returned with a changed attitude when it came to his men's tracking abilities. They not only found the animals' tracks, but also relied on their knowledge of wildlife habits to supply camp with fresh meat, whereas the white soldiers assigned to bring in fresh meat failed to do so in the same general area. Scouts tracking deserters always got their man. After three soldiers disappeared without a trace, the Apaches located the invisible trail because an observant scout found that a fast-moving horse had stumbled in a prairie dog hole and a piece of cactus had been broken off in an unnatural manner on down the trail. The scouts moved silently and quickly, using only hand signals. Within 24 hours, they had caught up with the deserters. This technique was repeated many times. Villa has the last laugh. Mexico was an untamed, desolate land, especially in the vast wilderness, Cordillera, known as the Sierra Madre. Villa knew the countryside. Pershing's troops did not. The campesinos loved Villa and his dorados. They hated the gringo. Mexicans did not want Americanos on their soil. Thus, the only real edge Pershing had were Apache scouts, recruited much as they had been in tracking down renegades during the Apache Wars of the last century. It was a wise decision. The punitive expedition was possibly the final military operation to enter combat in the old frontier style of warfare and emerge as a different force with truck convoys and men on mule or horseback riding side by side into a new modern era. That was unless they had to follow dim trails of outlaws and villistas into the rugged Sierra Madre. There were few roads. Mostly, there were dangerous paths following the terrain of canyon and gorge. Pershing knew it was important to use every resource and method to be successful in such terrain. These were not just trails into town plazas. They could be traps for his men. Villa, Fierro, and others might be hiding in the nearby hills. In some cases, that was true because the Apache scouts located caves along the stored supplies, ammunition, and arms. Nevertheless, despite using all resources available, Pershing was continually outfoxed by the clever revolutionaries. Some bloody incidents gained a few prisoners, as well as the anger of the Mexican residents of tiny pueblos, and this carried over into the large city of Chihuahua that was Pershing's headquarters. And, of course, the city was also Villa's old stomping grounds. It was embarrassing to admit, but after more than 11 months in the field and town, no había ni un señal. There was not even a sign of the Centaur of the North. There were lots of rumors and lightning-fast ambushes or raids for supplies and horses, but no Villa. The campesinos composed many corridos, folk songs. They serenaded. Maybe they have guns and cannons. Maybe they are a lot stronger. We have only rocks and mountains, but we know how to last longer. It must have been a bitter pill to accept that if it had not been for the Apache scouts, they would have never even gotten close to Jose Dorotio Arango Arambula, a.k.a. the bandit general Pancho Villa. Apache Twilight. After the punitive expedition ended in February 1917, the army disbanded about half of the force, leaving 22 Apache scouts for active duty at Fort Huachuca. Therefore, the wartime service was not yet over, though. Conflict between the United States and Mexican armies continued until 1920, and Apache renegades from the Sierra Madre harassed ranchers until the 1930s. They also formed borderland patrols and saw that cattle did not stray into Mexico. Nevertheless, service under General Pershing and the punitive expedition could be considered the last hurrah for the Apache Scouts. Hello, this is Michael, and I will be reading True West Magazine. It's the May-June 2024 edition. A Deadly Duel at 500 Yards by Bob Bozbell. Bass Reeves versus Jim Webb, the master of the long shot indeed. Based on the research of Art Burton. June 15, 1884. Out on the Whiskey Trail in Oklahoma Territory, Deputy U.S. Marshal Bass Reeves is hot on the trail of a murderer named Jim Webb, who the lawman had previously arrested and brought to justice in 1883. After a year in jail in Fort Smith, Webb got out on a $17,000 bond and skipped. Now Reeves got the word that Webb had drifted back into the Chickasaw Nation and was hiding out at Jim Bywater's general store on the south side of the Arbuckle Mountains. Riding with Reeves is Deputy John Cantrell, who Bath sends ahead to see if Webb is around. Sure enough, Cantrell spots Webb in the store and signals Reeves to come ahead. An eyewitness, D.C. Gideon, describes what happens next. As he went dashing up, Webb espied him, and jumping through the open window, armed with both revolver and Winchester, ran for his horse that stood about 100 yards away. Reeves cut him off from his horse, and Webb turned toward a clump of bushes, ran about 600 yards, turned, and fired. The first shot grazed the horn of Reeves' saddle. The second cut a button from his coat, and the third cut off both bridle reins below his hand, allowing them to fall to the ground. As Reeves jumped from his horse, another bullet cut the brim of his hat. Reeves then fired his first shot, and before Webb could fall, had sent two Winchester balls through his body. By this time, Reeves' posse and Messrs. Bywaters and Smith came running up. Webb lay on the ground with his revolver in his hand, calling Reeves to come to him. Reeves advanced, but while keeping his gun trained on him, told Webb to throw the revolver away. He flung it into the grass out of his reach, and the whole party walked up to the dying man. "Give me your hand, Bass," said Webb, as he extended his own with an effort to grasp it. "You are a brave man. I want you to accept my revolver and scabbard as a present, and you must accept them. Take it, for with it I have killed 11 men, 4 of them in Indian Territory, and I expected you to make the 12th. Bass accepted the present and has it now carefully stored away. The dying declaration of Webb was taken in writing by Mr. Bywaters, and thus ended the career of another bad man. The master of surprise and disguise. Bass Reeves preferred to arrest bad men by surprise to cut down the likelihood they might fire on him. According to Reeves' biographer, Art Burton, Bass did this in many different ways, from riding up on felons before they woke up in the morning, to using his many disguises and totally catching them off guard. Supposedly, one of Reeves's effective undercover disguises was to dress as a dirt poor farmer and pretend to be harmless, literally shuffling into an armed camp with his hands in his pockets. Bass invariably got the drop on his unsuspecting prey, sometimes more than one. With over 3,000 arrests to his credit, his achievements in using surprise and disguise are unparalleled and unmatched. Later in his career, Reeves trained many young deputies who worked in the Indian Territory. Aftermath, odds and ends. During Judge Parker's 20-year tenure on the bench in Fort Smith, some 75 to 100 deputies died in the line of duty. Bass Reeves made, on average, $400 a trip, and his biggest haul was bringing in 17 prisoners with a fee of $900. The U.S. Attorney General estimated that of the 20,000 whites living in the Indian Territory during the time Reeves was active, only 5,000 were law-abiding. Judge Parker, known as the Hanging Judge, actually hanged 30 whites, 26 Indians, and 23 blacks. While being interviewed by a newspaper in 1907, Reeves made the following remarks about the Webb shootout. "The bravest man I ever saw," said Reeves, "was Jack Jim Webb, a Mexican that I killed in 1884 near Sacred Heart Mission. He was a murderer. I got in between him and his horse. He stepped out into the open 500 yards away and commenced shooting with his Winchester. Before I could drop off my horse, his first bullet cut a button off my coat, and the second cut my bridle rein in two. I shifted my six-shooter and grabbed my Winchester and shot twice. He dropped, and when I picked him up, I found that my two bullets had struck within an inch, a half inch of each other. He shot four times, and every time he shot, he kept running closer to me. He was 500 yards away from me when I killed him." Recommended book: Black Gun, Silver Star, The Life and Legend of Frontier Marshal Bass Reeves by Art T. Burton. Bison Books, University of Nebraska Press. True West Magazine, August-September 2024 edition. Ride That Train by Stuart Rosebrook. Heritage Railroads keep the Old West alive across the United States. You never forget your first ride on steam-driven historic trains. From Alaska to North Carolina, all across North America, Heritage Railroads take passengers back in time to a simpler era when coal-fired steam engines drove trains over narrow-gauge lines up and over some of the most rugged and spectacular landscapes in the country. The editors of True West's tip their engineers' caps to the owners and preservationists who work so hard throughout the year to provide extraordinary experiences on their heritage trains for tourists of all generations from around the world. We recommend the following 12 historic railroads to ride and experience the Old West firsthand. Stuart Rosebrook, editor of True West, hopes that someday there will be heritage railways operating in all 50 states. Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad, Durango and Silverton, Colorado. Durango is a four-season destination. Since 1959, the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad has operated as a tourist train from May to October, with limited special rides in the winter and spring. The railroad makes it easy to customize an experience with different travel packages, including the adventurous Discover Silverton package and always popular Polar Express. When in Durango, enjoy the historic downtown district with its great variety of hotels, restaurants, pubs, and specialty shops. More info: DurangoTrain.com, Durango.org, DurangoFiestaDays.com. Good Sleeps, Historic Strattor Hotel, Strattor.com. Good Grub, Derailed Poor House, Derailed Poor, P-O-U-R, House.com. The Grand Canyon Railway, Williams, Arizona. On September 17, 1901, the Santa Fe Railway launched the 64-mile Grand Canyon Railway from Williams to the Grand Canyon, and it was a favorite line on the AT and SF system until 1968. Passenger service restarted in 1989 as the Grand Canyon Railway, with daily service to and from the national park, plus special packages and train events, such as Steam Saturdays, the first Saturday, May through October, the Pumpkin Patch Train, every weekend in October, and the Polar Express, November to January. More info: thetrain.com and experiencewilliams.com. Good Sleeps, Grand Canyon Railway Hotel, thetrain.com. Good Grub, Cruisers Cafe 66, cruisers66.com. Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad, Chama, New Mexico, and Antonito, Colorado. The Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad's San Juan Extension arrived in the village of Chama in January 1881 and operated until the 1960s. Local boosters and preservationists worked to save the most scenic section of the line between Chama, New Mexico, and Antonito, Colorado, and the two states jointly bought the route, tracks, and stations, opening the Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad to passenger service in 1970. The 64-mile railroad operates seasonally between May and October and offers several fare packages with lunch included and special trains, including firefighter and engineer school. More info, CumbresToltec.com and ChamaValley.com. Good sleeps. Chama, the parlor car bed and breakfast, parlorcar.com. Antonito, steam train hotel, steamtrainhotel.com. Good grub, Chama's, Foster's Hotel, Foster's1881.com. Antonito, Dos Hermanas, facebook.com/Dos Hermanas Dos. Charlie Russell Choo Choo, C-H-E-W-C-H-O-O, Lewistown, Montana. Gold was discovered near Lewistown in 1880, and the town became an important trading center. In 1903, after 8 years of construction, the Montana Railroad connected Lewistown with the Northern Pacific Railway. In 1908, the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad purchased the line and operated it as the Milwaukee Road until the 1980s. Today, the Charlie Russell Choo Choo keeps the spirit of the railroad alive with round-trip dinner train trips on a spur track from May to October and the popular North Pole Adventure in November and December. More info, MontanaDinnerTrain.com, LewistownChamber.com, and CentralMontanaFair.com. Good sleeps, Circle Bar Ranch, CircleBarRanch.com. Good grub, Big Spring Brewing, BigSpringBrewingMT.com. Nevada Northern Railway, Ely, Nevada. Founded after gold was discovered in 1878, Ely has been a mining train ever since. After copper boomed in the early 1900s, the Nevada Northern Railway was built in 1905-06. The 162-mile line connected the copper mining districts and the city with the national transcontinental lines of the Western Pacific Railroad and Southern Pacific Railroad. After the smelter closed in 1983, the train ceased running as well. Soon thereafter, a portion of the rail line was saved and reopened as the Nevada Northern Railway, which operates passenger trains daily, except holidays and Tuesdays, except in July and August. The National Historic Landmark Railway has exciting passenger car options, specialty trains, and even hands-on engineer training. More info, nnry.com, elynevada.net, and whitepinecountry.net. Good sleeps, Hotel Nevada, hotelnevada.com. Good grub, Cell Block Jailhouse, jailhousecasino.com. Georgetown Loop Railroad, Georgetown, Colorado. An 1859 silver strike during the Pikes Peak Gold Rush led to the founding of Georgetown. Mining continued to drive the growth of the mountain town, and in 1878, the Colorado Central Railroad reached Georgetown. In 1884, the engineering marvel, the Georgetown Loop, was completed as part of the Georgetown-Breckenridge and Leadville Railroad. The railroad operated until economic conditions forced it to close in 1938. The line was rebuilt and restored in the 1970s and 1980s, and the Georgetown Loop Railroad and Mining Park is the centerpiece attraction for a long weekend in the historic town. More info, GeorgetownLoopRR.com, Georgetown-Colorado.org. Good sleeps, Rose Street Bed and Breakfast, RoseStreetBNB.com. Good Grub, Cooper's on the Creek, CoopersOnTheCreek.com. Skunk Train, Fort Bragg and Willits, California. After its 1857 fort closed, Fort Bragg became a lumber town, and in 1885, the Fort Bragg Railroad Company opened the first rail line to haul redwood timber from the forests to the coast. The line was eventually bought out, expanded, and renamed the California Western Railroad and Navigation Company. While it remains a popular passenger line today, the 40-mile line was also a successful freight service until 2001. The Skunk Train offers two major passenger trains, the Pudding Creek Express from Fort Bragg and the North Spur Flyer from Willits. More info, skunktrain.com, fortbragg.com, willits.com, and visitmendocino.com. Good Sleeps, Ocean View Lodge, oceanviewlodging.com. Good Grub, Patterson's Pub, PattersonsPub.com. Leadville, Colorado and Southern Railroad, Leadville, Colorado. Originally the Denver, South Park and Pacific and Colorado and Southern, the railroad reached Leadville in 1880. The engineering marvel crossed the Continental Divide twice and went through the 1,285-foot Alpine Tunnel at 11,523 feet. Over the decades of railroad amalgamation, the Colorado and Southern continued to operate regularly to and from Leadville until 1981. Since 1988, the Leadville, Colorado and Southern Railroad has been thrilling passengers on its 2.5-hour journey through the St. Isabel National Forest in sight of the state's two highest peaks. Popular themed trips offered annually include the Wildflower Special and Fall Photo Weekend Special. More info, leadville-train.com, leadville.com, and leadvilletwinlakes.com. Good Sleeps, Historic Delaware Hotel, delawarehotel.com. Good Grub, Golden Burrow Cafe, goldenburrow.com. Virginia and Truckee Railroad, Carson City and Virginia City, Nevada. Carson City was founded in 1858 and grew quickly after the Comstock Lode Gold and Silver Discovery in 1859. The Virginia and Truckee Railroad was completed between Carson City and Virginia City in 1870, and by 1872, it was connected to the Transcontinental Central Pacific in Reno. The short line connected the state capital and the rich mining districts to the world, and the towns boomed. With the mines mostly closed in the 1920s and 1930s, the railroad slowly failed, closing in 1950. In 1975, railroad entrepreneur Robert Gray reopened the VNT and operates it as a tourist train between Memorial Day and October. Passengers will enjoy the 35-minute conductor-led tour between the two historic cities. The train also offers specialty trips, including a Polar Express. More info, vtrailway.com, visitcarsoncity.com, and visitvirginiacitynv.com. Good Sleeps, Gold Hill Hotel and Saloon, goldhillhotel.net. Good Grub, Red Dog Saloon, reddogvc.rocks. Abilene and Smoky Hills Railroad, Abilene, Kansas. In the annals of Kansas railroad cowtowns, Abilene, Kansas is the granddaddy of them all. Joseph McCoy's entrepreneurial vision of building stockyards and a drover's cottage next to the end of the Kansas and Pacific tracks in Abilene, and advertising his services to Texas cattlemen in 1867, created the legendary cattle drive era of 1867 to 87. Abilene has maintained its connection to its Old West past, through the Abilene and Smoky Hills Railroad, Old Abilene Town, and the Dickinson County Heritage Center. The A&SHRR operates from May to October, with many exciting rides and tour opportunities for passengers, including steam-driven service on a limited basis, dinner trains, and the Silver Flyer Rail Bus. More info, asvrr.org and abilenecityhall.com. Good Sleeps, Ingle House Bed and Breakfast, inglehouse.com. Good Grub, Brookville Hotel Restaurant, brookvillehotel.com. 1880 Train, Hill City, South Dakota. Hill City was founded in 1876 during the first years of the Black Hills Gold Rush. The first mine and smelter owners of the Black Hills knew the rugged mountain region would need a railroad to make the mining of the rich underground veins profitable. It was not until the 1890s that regular rail service reached Hill City. Over time, diesel locomotives replaced all the steam engines driving trains in the Black Hills and America. Since 1957, William B. Heckman and Robert Freer's dream of the Black Hills Central Railroad's 1880 train has been thrilling passengers every summer for 60 years. More info, 1880train.com. Visit hillcitysd.com and blackhillsbadlands.com. Good Sleeps, Alpine Inn, alpineinhillcity.com. Good Grub, Powder House Restaurant, powderhouserestaurant.com. Arkansas and Missouri Railroad, Springdale and Van Buren, Arkansas. The Arkansas-Missouri Railroad line originated with the construction of the St. Louis-San Francisco Railway through the Springdale area in the 1880s. The modern A&MRR was started in 1986 and still serves a primary purpose of the original railway, freight, but also has a popular passenger tourist line that keeps a regular but limited schedule from January to November. The A&M has two round-trip passenger train options, Springdale to Van Buren and Van Buren to Winslow, both of which take tourists through the beautiful Boston Range of the Ozark Mountains, and special trains are offered throughout the year. More info, amrailroad.com and explorespringdale.com. Good Sleeps, Inn at the Mill, innatthemill.com. Good Grub, The Rail, railpizza.com. Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the August-September edition of True West Magazine. Collecting American Outlaws by Jana Bommersback. Wilbur Zink has preserved the younger gang's history in more ways than one. Growing up in Missouri in the 1930s, Wilbur Zink loved listening to family legends as he sat at the dinner table. The one that impressed him was the story of his grandfather, David Crowder, who was a teenager when the Pinkertons killed John Younger in 1874. A shopkeeper's son in Roscoe, Missouri, Crowder stood guard over the body. Guarding a dead man? Zink says that's not as strange as it sounds, considering what often happened to the bodies of the infamous. The custom in those days was to cut off an ear and pickle it, or show off a body at a Wild West show. Roscoe wasn't far from Zink's own home of Springfield, and that family tie inspired him to study what became his first book, The Roscoe Gun Battle. That research led him to seek out items owned by the Youngers and their partners in crime, Jesse and Frank James. Zink amassed thousands of items, which would ultimately inspire him to save the Younger homestead. "The first thing I got was Jim Younger's violin," said Zink from his Scottsdale, Arizona home, where he and his wife have wintered for the last 28 years before returning to Springfield. As he notes, Jim ended up in prison, where he was visited by an old sweetheart who had gotten married and had a daughter. Jim gave the little girl his violin, the only thing he had to offer as a gift. Zink knew none of that when he wrote to the daughter decades later. His interest in this elderly woman was really to find out about her late mother, who had written a historical novel about Missouri. He wondered if she had left behind any research that could be valuable to his own work. Unfortunately, she had not, but the inquiry led to a friendship, as Zink learned the woman was all alone, having survived a husband and a son who would have been Zink's age. "She favored me," he says, "and their friendship led to a wonderful gift. She gave him Jim Younger's violin, which he has to this day." "I bought Cole Younger's spurs," he remembered, "selling them along the way." He owned Jesse James's gun belt, bought from a collector who had gotten it through a pallbearer at Jesse's funeral. He owns Jesse's gold tie pin, and he eventually bought the entire James family collection of 25 letters from Frank James to his wife Anna, written while he was in jail awaiting trial. Zink is turning that treasure trove into another book that will be named after a command Frank included in his letters. "Burn these letters." Zink calls that collection his most exciting find. "I've spoken all over Missouri on the James family and the Youngers," Zink says, estimating he has given more than 100 speeches to civic and religious gatherings on the history of their own backyards. Those lectures were given on top of his two-day jobs. He was a Ford dealer for 50 years and a pastor for small Christian churches. While he collected these pieces of history, he came across a building that he decided should be saved for history's sake, the Younger Homestead. The homestead is a two-story pre-Civil War home with a small front porch and four bedrooms upstairs. A simple house, it is constructed of wood with lap shingles. Its lifetime not only included housing the Younger family, but also being transformed into an antique shop before sitting empty for several years. "Somebody poked a large hole on one end, and it was in bad shape," Zink remembers. The development of a new subdivision meant the old homestead was scheduled for demolition. That's when Zink and his collaborator, author Marley Brandt, stepped in. She has also written about the Youngers and also wanted to see this piece of history saved from the bulldozer. She put up the money to buy the decrepit house, while Zink supervised the tearing down and cataloging of every board. Then he stored all the pieces of the house in his barn for two decades before he and Brandt donated all to the Cass County Historical Society, which plans to reconstruct it at a proper site someday. Editor's note, the house has yet to be reconstructed. Meanwhile, Zink has the equivalent of a museum in his own home. "We have an 11-room house in Springfield, but my wife doesn't like having all this stuff around, so most of it is packed up in the basement," Zink says. He is keeping good records of it all, writing notes for his son and daughter, detailing the items they will inherit someday. "I collected all this stuff to work on when I got old, and I'm there," Zink says with a laugh. He still has the collecting bug. He's working on a collection of letters from Jesse and Frank's parents, Robert, who was a minister, and his wife, Zerelda. Perhaps material for another book? Who knows? What he does know is that his collections mean something special. It's important to preserve history for our children or grandchildren, or it will be lost, says Zink, sounding very much like an Old West savior. Editor's note, after Wilbur Zink died in 2010, his family entrusted Heritage Auctions to gavel off his collection in 2013. True West Magazine, August-September 2024 edition. Firearms with a Storied Past by Steve Friesen. Rock Island gavels off high profits from historic firearms. Rock Island Auction Company's final sale of 2023 was exceptional, grossing $26.7 million. One of their premier auctions, it was promoted by three catalogs filled with firearms used in the West. Many were accompanied by stories of their owners and the part they played in history. In 1853, Jonathan Browning joined the Mormon migration from Illinois to Utah, settling in Ogden. There he opened a gunsmithing shop. His sons continued their father's work, operating the Browning Company in 1878. Jonathan's harmonica rifle, created before he made the trek, sold for $49,938. Professor William Henry Brewer moved west to California in 1860 to take part in its first geological survey. He also took part in later exploratory expeditions to the Rocky Mountains, Greenland, and Alaska. His engraved Colt 1851 Navy revolver sold for $25,438. In 1875, Montana pioneer Thomas Stewart received a gift of a model 1873 rifle from his brother. Made by Winchester, it was part of a rare series referred to as One of 1,000. Inscribed to Thomas, the rifle went for $528,750. Arthur William Merrifield was Theodore Roosevelt's hunting guide on his first hunts in the West in the 1880s. Roosevelt gave Merrifield an engraved Merwin, Hulbert & Company 3rd Model Army revolver, together with a cartridge belt and a pocket watch. The set fetched $164,500. By the time he purchased his 1881 deluxe model Marlin, Clinton L. White was well established in California law and politics. Years later, the Marlin was acquired by another Californian and avid hunter, actor Tom Selleck. It sold for $99,875 at the premier auction. Selleck's collection also included a Shiloh Sharps rifle made for use by him in the title role for the movie Quigley Down Under. It sold for $105,750. Some of the firearms at the auction had been favored by women because they were small and light. One was a nicely embellished Colt pocket revolver inscribed to F.W. Jacobs on its backstrap. Frances Weisbart Jacobs and her husband moved to Denver in the 1860s, traveling in a wagon train from Ohio. Made in 1877, the Colt was probably acquired after the two opened Denver's OK clothing store. Her revolver sold for $32,313. Another Colt, a Lightning Baby carbine, was shorter and lighter than most shoulder arms. Journalist Robert E. Strayhorn presented one as a Christmas gift to his wife, Carrie, in 1888. Strayhorn traveled around the West with his wife, who may have taken some comfort from having the carbine. Her baby sold for $21,150. The lavishly illustrated catalogs for the December 2023 Rock Island Premier Auction can be visited online. The images of the firearms are outstanding, and the stories associated with them make interesting reading. True West Magazine, May-June 2024 edition. Doc Holliday, Reward Money and Fast Draw, by Marshall Trimble. After a gunfight or Indian attack, what happened to the weapons of the fallen? Edward Preskin, Mobile, Alabama. To the victor go the spoils. If Indians won a battle, and if time permitted, they could gather in the loot, clothes, firearms, and ammunition to stock their needs. When the Army collected non-military firearms after a battle, such as repeating rifles, ammo, etc., the arms were sent back to the Rock Island Arsenal, Illinois. From there, they would likely be sold as surplus, and the winner of a gunfight could claim the weapons of his opponent if he chose to. What happened when Doc Holliday was in Prescott, Arizona? Bill Jenkins, Shreveport, Louisiana. Prescott historian Brad Courtney informed me Doc and Kate left Las Vegas, New Mexico in October 1879, bound for Prescott with Wyatt and James Earp and their families. The Earps headed for Tombstone in December, but Doc and Kate remained through the winter. Wyatt kept urging him to join them in Tombstone, but rather he headed back to Las Vegas that spring to pay off some debts while Kate went to Globe. According to the 1880 census, Doc was back in Prescott before June and remained until August before heading to Tombstone. Were lawmen able to collect reward money? Roger Tinkenberg Westminster, Colorado. Yes, most lawmen, federal and local, could collect rewards in addition to regular pay. For some, that money was necessary to get by, and he could also put in for expenses like travel, food for the animals, housing, etc. When Indians attacked wagon trains, did they really ride around the wagons in a circle like they show in the movies? Ed Dickens, Joplin, Missouri. Attacks on large wagon trains were rare, if ever, especially if an experienced wagon boss was in charge. He demanded discipline and always had a defense plan in case of an attack. Indians might attack a small train of two or three wagons, but it was usually an ambush. Occasionally, they would pay a social visit to the wagon train just to probe for weakness or lack of discipline. If they found it was well defended, they'd go looking for another prey. And their tactics depended on the situation they faced. Who was John Portugee Phillips? Joe Manriquez, Whittier, California. Early in 1866, John Portugee Phillips joined a party that was coming to the Bighorn Mountains to prospect for gold. His group arrived at Fort Phil Kearny on September 14th, and he was at the fort during the Fetterman fight on December 21st. After Fetterman was killed, Colonel Henry Carrington felt the fort might fall into the hands of the Sioux. He asked for volunteers to venture out into the blizzard and below zero temperatures and ride to Fort Laramie to bring a relief force. Phillips and another man took the best two horses at the fort, including Carrington's personal mount. The faithful horse that carried Phillips the 236 miles through minus 20 degree temperatures, high winds, blowing snow, and deep drifts, died soon after the ride was completed. For some reason, the government refused to pay Phillips and the other rider. Phillips died in 1883. In 1900, the government paid his widow, Hattie, $5,000. She used some of the money to erect an elaborate monument in his honor in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Were fast draw artists a common thing in the Old West, or are they largely an invention of pulp fiction in Hollywood? Sean Coate, Fort Fairfield, Maine. Hollywood invented the fast draw. In reality, it was a factor in only a handful of gunfights. What really mattered was accuracy. The most dangerous man in a fight was a man willing to kill, who had no hesitation to pull his pistol and fire. Wyatt Earp allegedly put it plain and simple: take your time in a hurry. Even if he didn't say that exactly, the point still holds.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.